Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Fiat. Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 295 for July 17th of 2015. Lessons learned from the BMW i3. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary, here we are at it again. Another Autoline After Hours.
Absolutely.
So you had a fun week so far?
So far, yeah. Driving the new Hyundai Tucson, and we can't talk to you about that.
Oh, that's embargoed?
It's embargoed.
Okay. In fact, I think you were driving one with the chap sitting next to you, Gary Witzenberg, joining us again on...
Well, not exactly in the same vehicle, but at the same time.
At the same event. Same event.
Right.
So, how you doing there, Gary?
Good. Staying busy.
Busy's good, especially for a freelancer like yourself, right?
Exactly, right.
And, of course, we got to let everybody know that we're being joined today by our special guest, John Kelly, with BMW Product Management. John, great having you here. Not just you, but the BMW i3 in the studio as well.
Yeah, thank you, John. I'm very excited to be here, and I'm really happy to talk to you about the i3. It's a great car. There's so much to say. There's such a great story. So, yeah, I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Well, I got a million questions, but I'm dying to hear what Gary Witzenberg wants to ask, because Gary was working on the GM EV1 program. So I figure if any of us here know something other than John Kelly about EVs, it's Gary Witzenberg.
Well, that one, as you know, didn't work out very well commercially, but it was a great technological success. It was and still is probably the most energy efficient vehicle ever to roll down the road, at least reasonably practical vehicle, but it only had two seats and was kind of expensive and didn't go very far with lead acid batteries at the time. Come a long way since then.
And part of the way that we've come is with this i3, but what's the first question to John Kelly, Gary?
I do have one ready, as a matter of fact, and that is that the regen in the i3. And I've driven it only once so far, and that was at the event that you had in California before the LA Auto Show about a year and a half ago. The regen is always on. It's always strong. And to me, I find that occasionally annoying. I know it's good for range. It's good for energy. But every time you lift off, it just really, really drags the car down quickly. And that's been consistent through the other BMW EVs. Mm-hmm. There are other solutions to that. One, I think the VW, you can set different levels. In the EV1, you had a button you could just turn it on or off. You could coast freely or get regen and whichever you chose for efficiency. Yep. And I think you, if I remember correctly, you have a neutral position on the pedal. So if you do it exactly right, you can coast freely at higher speeds. But at lower speeds, it's always jerking you a little bit. Have you guys ever rethought that?
Well, you hit the nail on the head.
And is the customer feedback good on that?
It is, and that's actually why it is the way that it is. But you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned that neutral point. So if you think about the accelerator, if you go full throttle, for example, you have maximum power, and when you start backing off, you come to a neutral point where the car basically coasts. And then once you pull back a little bit further, you start to get into brake regen. If you pull back just a little bit of regen. If you pull back all the way and let off the throttle completely, you get full brake regen. Whereas when you touch the brake pedal, that's 100% service brakes. That's hydraulic brakes only. Hmm. And one of the things that we focused on very heavily with the i3 is listening to our customers and asking them what they want, how they want it changed. We have through the BMW USA website, we have a forum that we administer. We have our customer relations team and some engineers involved in it. And we encourage our customers to, and potential customers for that matter, if they have questions, if they have problems, complaints, we want to hear about it. It'll make the car better in the end. And we also had field trials. So we started in 2008 with the electric Mini. And we did, I think it was 500 cars. And then in 2011, we had the Active E1 Series Electric, right, which proved some of the powertrain components that we now have in the i3. And one of the things that we got out of those trials was these were early adopters, very tech-savvy, EV-centric people. And we asked them what they thought, what they wanted. And one thing they said was they consistently wanted as much regen as possible. Mm. And of course, there are many scenarios. It's a rear-wheel drive car, rear engine, rear-wheel drive, 50-50 weight distribution. It's a very balanced, nice driving car, great driving dynamics. But in certain situations, you don't want as much regen because it is rear-wheel drive. And the system compensates automatically for that.
Go ahead, Gary.
No, I was going to say, so, you know, you mentioned that you've got a lot of feedback from real people who would be real customers for this car before you developed it. So basically, with this, the i3, you guys had the opportunity to look at everything fresh rather than having some preconceived notions of what an electric car ought to be?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's certain things that we know, certain competencies we already had. We had a couple generations of hybrids. We had these trial electric vehicles. So we had certain competencies already and certain things we knew we wanted to do. But then we took a ground-up approach with this car. So everything up until now was a modification of an existing platform, the last one being the 1 Series Electric. It was a 1 Series body in white that was modified to fit all the EV drivetrain components. The end result is it tends to be a little bit heavy. It was about 4,000 pounds. And to get the equal range that this car has, you had to have a very sizable battery. I want to say it was around 32 kilowatt hours. With this car, it's a totally different approach. It was a ground-up, start-from-nothing approach, so we could do it exactly the way we wanted to, really maximize the driving dynamics. It is a BMW, after all. You know, it has to have BMW driving dynamics. We could also, we went with carbon fiber, which I'd like to talk about a little bit. All these things to minimize weight, maximize the interior volume, which is really very impressive. And it also allows us to go with the right size battery. So by lightening the car all around, you can get a similar range out of a smaller battery. So this car has its gross 22 kilowatt hours, net 18.8 kilowatt hours. So it's a full third less than what we had in the Active E with similar range. So this ground-up approach, really from the ground up, allowed us to tailor it to exactly what we want and what our customers want. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of your customers, the car's now been in their hands for over a year. What are you learning from it? What are you going, really? They're using it that way? Or what are the customer experiences telling you about your car that you didn't know beforehand?
One thing they're telling us, which I think I was hoping we would expect, was that they love it. I mean, unanimously, the customers are generally very happy with the car, the way it's performing, the quality level, the driving dynamics, and so forth. As far as who the customers are, again, kind of what we expected. We had the early adopters, the really tech-savvy people. Maybe they're coming from a hybrid or another EV, but it's evolved. Now we're getting customers that are using it as an alternative to their other combustion engine car. People you wouldn't expect to be the super tech-savvy people that would be early adopters. So the customer is kind of what we would expect. What's a little bit different, though, is the use case. So originally, we expected it to be more people using it as a commuter car. It's an urban car, suburban commuter-type car. And what we were surprised to learn was how many people buy it as a second car to supplement their combustion engine car, figuring they'll use that car on the weekends for their long trips and whatnot, and then they're not using it. They're using this car all the time. So we've had the car on the market for just over a year now. We have over 10,000 of them on the road, and we have some customers with over 30,000 miles on them. So it's pretty impressive. The use case is what's a little bit different, that we have some customers that have their second car and they just don't use it anymore.
So you mentioned in passing the carbon fiber. Yep. So it's an aluminum chassis with carbon fiber on top?
That's right. So we refer to it as the life module and the drive module. So life module being the whole passenger compartment. There's essentially three pieces of body construction that are worth noting. You have the body cell, which is carbon fiber. So it's all structural carbon fiber. Then you have the drive module, which is essentially an aluminum frame. So you have extrusions, you have cast parts welded together and whatnot. And then you have the outer body panels, which is a really good story. They're all thermoplastic, with the exception of the roof, which is carbon fiber, and the tailgate, which is primarily glass. These thermoplastic panels, it's one of the great benefits of the car, both carbon fiber, aluminum, and the body panels. If we have time for this anyway, I'd love to talk to you about how we repair these things, because it's a really great story. If you think about a traditional car with a steel or aluminum quarter panel, If it gets dented, it's a pretty significant repair. You have to cut it out. You have to weld in a new one. And this car, they're all bolt-on panels. They're all bolt-on carbon fiber panels. You literally unsnap the old panel, paint the new one, snap it right on. Carbon fiber is another interesting one, because if you think about carbon fiber, which it's pretty extraordinary, to be honest, that we have a carbon fiber passenger cell in a car that retails for $42,000 before incentives. And if you had a typical supercar, Formula One, that type of thing, where you have a carbon fiber monocoque, it's very expensive and very energy intensive to produce this. You end up hand laying it, putting in an autoclave and all that. We have a very different approach where we cure the parts in the mold. So it is a resin transfer molding process. But essentially what happens is your carbon fiber woven mat goes into the press. It closes. Resin is injected under heat and pressure. It cures, pops out. You trim it. It goes on to the next step. All these different parts are then bonded together using structural adhesive. And it's of course, one that was specially designed for this application. What's good about this is if the car is in an accident, one thing that's nice also about an accident is with carbon fiber, the energy is very localized. It's absorbed in a very localized area. So you don't generally end up with a car with a front impact that ends up with rear doors that don't quite line up and a ripple in the C-pillar and so forth. So it's easier to localize the energy. And to repair it, it's not as complicated as some of these supercars where it'd be a very complicated repair. In this case, it's more like a steel repair where you cut out the bad section and weld in a new section. Here, you grind out the old section, cut the adhesive, and simply bond in a new component. It's really
in fact,
very
there's cut lines molded into the cell structure, the structure of it, yep. to show where to cut them out.
Yeah, exactly. And
that happened much? Have BMW dealers had to cut out sections, repair them, and how's that all gone?
It's been going fine, from what I understand. There haven't been any significant accidents, but there have been some cars with some body repairs and some carbon fiber repairs. And I'm not aware of any problems with it.
So it doesn't have an effect on the structural rigidity of the vehicle if you cut this section out and glue in a new one?
Absolutely not.
Wow.
The adhesive is like the strongest part of it. So in fact, we saw demonstrations where if you overlap two pieces with the adhesive in the middle, of course, and you pull them apart, the carbon, whether it's carbon fiber or aluminum using the structural adhesive, the carbon fiber or the aluminum tears mm-hmm. before the adhesive bond is ever broken. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't affect rigidity.
So looking at this vehicle, what people see, the outer skin, is pretty much a thermoplastic material, not the carbon fiber material.
That's right. Okay. The carbon fiber on the outside that you see is just on the roof skin. And that's more of a, I guess you'd call it a class A surface, mm-hmm. a customer look and feel surface. Mm-hmm. If you open either one of the doors, that's where you see structural carbon fiber, the whole opening. So the B-pillar is technically integrated into the rear door. So you open up both doors with the rear coach door.
You can see it there.
In the whole door frame opening, like you can see on the bottom there, mm-hmm. that's all structural carbon fiber.
Right.
And it's left unfinished for a reason. So it's in your face. You can see that this is structural
carbon fiber. So it looks cool and you're able to say, I got a carbon fiber car.
Yeah. and it's also, it's a good story because this is revolutionary that we can produce a car and sell it for $42,000 with all this carbon fiber in it. It's something we've been involved in for years. I think it was 2001 when we first had a carbon fiber reinforcement panel behind the bumper in the M3. But it's something that, as our competencies are developing, our partnership with SGL Carbon Fiber is strengthened, and we're refining these production processes, it makes sense to transfer this over to other models going forward. So I don't know if you saw the new G12 7 Series, which we'll be launching in the fall. This car uses what we call a carbon core. So it's not a carbon fiber passenger cell, but it's basically carbon fiber reinforcements within steel, so you can make it smaller, thinner, lighter, and so forth.
Can we talk about the extended range version of the i3 for a minute? I'm a proponent, a fan of extended range electric vehicles. For example, Chevrolet Volt, you can go 30 to 40 miles on, grid power alone, which is inexpensive, and you're not burning any fuel at all. And then you can drive across the country if you want, like a conventional car, just by using gas after that point. Or you can choose to recharge it whenever you have a chance or not. Yours, as I understand, it's a 650cc two-cylinder BMW engine that mounts in the back, gives you, 30-some horsepower, I believe. I forget the number. Mm-hmm. And it doubles the range, roughly, from 60 to 100 to double that. It adds, what, $4,000 in cost, something like that?
Roughly.
And some weight, which is in the back. What I'm getting to, though, what is the take rate on that at the added cost, added weight? And are those customers as happy with those vehicles as your pure battery EV i3 customers are?
I don't know about the satisfaction rates between the two. I simply haven't seen that information. But as far as how the system works and the premium and the take rate, I know it was around 50% or a little slightly over 50%, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And what's interesting about it is we have gotten a lot of feedback from these customers. And the one thing that they're telling us is, by and large, they're not using it on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So they're not buying the car because they, if their daily commute is 120 miles, so they know that they need to use it for that last 30 miles every day. They're not buying it for that reason. Most customers buy it because the regular battery electric version fits into their driving profile, but they're not quite sure because maybe they need to take a long trip on the weekend or they're just not comfortable with the restriction.
It's the added range is there if they need it
exactly
on a given day, which takes care of some of that range anxiety that people have with the pure
exactly
EV.
That's exactly what it is.
Right.
Yeah. And we're finding that most of these customers, the ones that are you know, feeding us information anyway, is that most of them are either using the Rex very little or not at all. So it runs a maintenance cycle. Every 8 weeks, it starts up and runs that load for 20 minutes to make sure that it burns off any moisture in the oil and lubricates the bearings and all that good stuff. And we're finding a lot of customers, that's the only time it runs is when it does the maintenance cycle.
Yeah. Could part of the reason be that it's loud? I have not driven the i3 with the range extender.
Nor have I yet.
But I have talked to colleagues of mine who have, and they go, wow, that thing's really loud back there.
Yeah, I'm actually a little surprised to hear that. Because can you hear it running? Yes, it is a combustion engine that's running. But what's great about it, unfortunately, the car we have on display for you is a battery electric version, which, of course, you're welcome to drive after the show if you'd like.
Thank you. I'll take it.
but the range extender version, like you mentioned, it's a two-cylinder, 650cc engine, never drives the wheels. It simply drives a generator to feed energy either to the traction motor or back to the battery. And one of the great things about this engine is it's a good engine to begin with, but if you think about a typical combustion engine in any typical car, it needs to run from 700 RPM to 7,000 RPM at all different load points in between. So there's no way you could possibly tune your balance shafts and your dampers and your motor mounts and all the rest of it to tune out all those first and second order vibrations everywhere. Whereas this engine only runs at certain specified speeds and certain specified load conditions. So it's much easier to tune that out. So as a result, the NVH characteristics are very impressive. So like I said, can you hear it running? Yes. Mm-hmm. But is it loud and objectionable? I don't think so.
Well, maybe it's because the electric car itself is so quiet that when this comes on, it's just like, whoa, what's that?
It's a contrast.
Absolutely.
I had another concern about it, too, and I confess I still have not driven one. I think I am scheduled to get one in a few weeks, so I'm looking forward to that to try it out. But I also wonder about if you're down, if the battery is to the point where that starts, which means you're running, it's only generating electricity to keep you going. Does it have enough reserve power performance, for example, to, what's the performance on a steep hill? Or if you need to pass somebody on a two-lane road or something like that. I wonder about, it's a 34-horsepower engine. I don't know how much wattage it can put out to keep that little motor going at a what a BMW customer would say was acceptable performance level.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing to consider is that the Rex engine drives the generator, which then drives the traction motor.
Right.
So your generator is not driving the traction motor directly, and your battery always has some reserve energy in it. So for the most part, you still have full power to the traction motor.
So you would not notice the difference in performance whether or not the engine is running, whether or not the battery is down to the point where the engine starts, is what you're saying.
When the engine starts, absolutely, you're correct. Yeah. If you got to the point where you depleted the battery completely, then, of course, you would have certain power reductions.
Yeah.
But by and large, it's not a problem, and because there is that reserve in the battery. And I've found, I don't know all the statistics, I'm sorry, but I found from my personal use that when I'm driving the car, which I drive at home very often, on the Rex, I can cruise at 75 miles an hour on the highway with the air conditioning on, and I've never experienced that degradation.
But not indefinitely. At some point, you're going to...
At 75.
It's a 2.4 gallon gas tank, I think. You're only going to go so far with that. And at some point, you're going to get some degradation in performance.
But that 24-gallon gas tank at some point is going to run out. So, yeah. I mean, that's just the nature of...
That's one of the nice things. It's it is a we use a 1.9-gallon tank here in the U.S.
Oh.
And if you run low on fuel, if you need to, you can stop and get more fuel. But like I said, this is what we've found is that most customers are not using it on a very regular basis.
You know, Gary mentioned driving like a BMW, and earlier you mentioned that this had to drive like a BMW. And, you know, I'm wondering, for an electric car, can you have, like, a front drive, or is rear drive provide something to the nature of the car?
Well, I think having the rear engine and rear drive, for one, adds to the 50-50 weight distribution. Having the battery mounted so low and the carbon fiber up high, you have a low center of gravity, and the car handles like a BMW. It's really wonderful.
In fact, I want to ask you more about that. I know you've got satisfied customers, but they're early adopters. I want to hear what other BMW owners say about the car, too. But we're going to take a quick break right now and listen to a spot from our friends from Bridgestone.
The Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, we're back. And now we've got a number of questions in from the audience. Let's see. We'll take the first one from Todd. He says, I was one of the folks driving the Mini E 50,000 miles and the Active E over 40,000 miles, and I love the regen, he says. Single pedal driving is relaxing, i.e. you don't have to use the brake pedal, and provides a more pleasant driving experience, especially in stop-and-go traffic. At first, it may be startling, but you soon realize how wonderful it is. So there's one. And then Rick Bradner from Vancouver, British Columbia, says, speaking of customer feedback, what do they not like?
What do they not like? I'll be honest. I can't think of anything in particular that they don't like. One thing that we've heard a few complaints about is the exterior styling. Of course, it's a little polarizing, and it's not for everybody. By and large, the feedback is positive, but... not 100%. And to be honest, though, that's actually one of the reasons why I enjoy driving the car so much is because I truly love the car and I truly enjoy talking about it. And whether you love the styling or dislike it, it gets your attention. And not many days go by where I'm driving the car and I'm at the shopping center or whatever, and somebody doesn't, you know, either come over and ask a question, say, what is that? Or, you know, is that one of those electric cars? What do you think of it? It's great.
Well, the interior's interesting, too. Very different. And I wonder if that design was driven partially by the desire for it to be different, to be appropriate for a very different kind of car, or also, I know it's sustainable materials. That's a big part of what's in there. But to me, it's kind of strange. I wonder if people are happy with that as well, or a little bit less so.
My experience...
the appearance.
...has been 100% positive on the interior. Everybody seems to really love it. And one of the nice things is you have so much freedom with a ground-up design like this.
Yeah.
So there's no tunnel. It's so spacious. I drive with two kids with car seats in the back, and I'm 6'3", and they have no problem sitting behind me. The exterior package, the footprint, is relatively small. It's about the footprint of a 1 Series. But the interior volume is like that of a 3 Series. It's really very...
spaciousness, the ingress, the egress, all of that is great.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering about the appearance of the instrument panel and a few other things that are take some getting used to.
I haven't heard any complaints about it.
Really?
And one of the stories we like to tell is about, you know, the sustainability factor in the interior. Mm-hmm. So like the wood that you can see there on screen, that's eucalyptus wood. This car has the cloth and the cloth seats, but the car with leather seats and the Terra model. It uses olive leaf extract as one of the tanning agents for the seats. And we use Kenaf fibers and some of the door panel components and so forth. So,
all highly recyclable.
Right. Yep.
Okay, we got another here. Dodge Donut wants to know, since the i3 is rear drive, can you do a burnout with that instant electric torque?
Well, I can tell you the instant electric torque is great. This car takes off. The performance is outstanding. Unfortunately, you can't do burnouts or donuts with the car. We have a dynamic stability control system that is not fully defeatable.
It's electronically limited, I would think, to prevent that.
Well, yes.
Yeah, to prevent spinning tires.
Exactly. As soon as you have wheel slippage, the stability program kicks in and starts to dial back the torque to prevent you from doing donuts.
So Kville Kia, if I've said that right, wants to know, what makes the i3 more attractive to buyers than the lower-priced competitors, i.e. lower-priced, I'm assuming, electric cars?
Okay. Without getting into specifics about our competition, which I'd rather not do, this is a premium electric vehicle. And that's one of the things that really sets it apart from its competition, is it is a premium vehicle. It's a BMW. It has BMW driving dynamics. If you haven't driven one yet, I encourage you to do so, because it's an absolute blast to drive. So from driving dynamics, feature set, premium materials, and so forth, it really does set itself apart.
The brand name, the cachet of the BMW brand, but also I think the fact that it is purpose-built, where all of the rest of them are conversions.
Absolutely.
Except Tesla.
And it may be, except Tesla. I'm not considering that
a
direct competitor, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not of this car, right.
But also, are there any other rear drive ones? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
You know, we're seeing the charging on screen right now. And so I was wondering about, you know, the issue of if someone buys this car, where do they charge it? I mean...
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting... There was a study, actually two studies. One was, if I'm not mistaken, it was a DOT study, and then one was one of our internal studies from our Mini-E and Active-E drivers. I forget which is which. One was, I think, 33 miles, one was 36 miles, but the average daily commute. And with an 80 to 100-mile range on this car, especially if you precondition it to warm the battery and warm or cool the cabin... While you're plugged into the grid, you should have enough energy where you only need to charge at home. But of course, there's public charging infrastructure, which is especially strong on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So there are places to plug in. Generally, people charge at home. With a car like this, with an 18.8 kilowatt hour battery, you would generally want to have a level 2 charger, which will charge in this car up to 7.4 kilowatts. With some of the smaller batteries like you might find in a PHEV, which might be, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 kilowatt hours, that you might be able to get away with just the standard 110-volt occasional use cable, which is generally around 1.3 kilowatts.
Will this charge with 110?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We actually unplugged
just
it.
Just take all day long, though.
It's very slow.
In fact, just before we started the show, it was plugged in onto the occasional use cable.
No, I was wondering, because I just got out of one of the non-premium electric cars just this very week, and I thought it was interesting that on their nav system it indicated where there were charging stations. Mm-hmm. One charging station was at a competitive brand's dealership. One charging station was behind a fence in an office complex. I mean, it was just like, this isn't good when I'm driving around. And I was just wondering about the availability of you know, BMW owners being able to charge up their vehicle.
We do have a similar setup with our navigation system. It will identify charging stations.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I've personally tested them, so I don't know if any are located behind fences and whatnot.
No, I've been in other EVs, and they'll show you everything that's out there. You may not want to use it.
I had an experience when I was the last time I had a Volt press vehicle, and I was heading to the airport for a trip, and I said, I'm going to play like I'm a real owner here and see if I can charge while I'm gone at the airport. And I got on the internet quickly on the way to the airport and found there were charging stations on the 8th floor of the main parking deck or something like that. Took me about 20 minutes to find them. And there were two of them, and they were, of course, both being used. So I was very grateful that it wasn't a pure battery EV that I really needed the charge. So that was one thing, and then it cost me twice as much to park there as it would have in a satellite lot. So you know, basically, I'm being a little facetious, but if you are in a pure EV without a range extender and you're counting on public charging at an airport or anywhere else, that could be an issue because there might be two, and one of them's down, and the other one's in use, and it still takes a long time.
There's been media reports of arguments breaking out between Volt and Leaf owners.
Yeah.
And the Leaf owners telling the Volt guys, get off
we
the plug.
It.
I need it.
Yeah.
You don't.
Exactly. The two that were parked in at the airport were Volts also, by the way. Yeah. So the Leaf people were out of luck, I guess.
After the show, I'll tell you where else you can plug in. Armand wants to know, though, John Kelly. He points out Ford dealers had to spend tens of thousands of dollars to gear up for aluminum repairs of the Ford F-150. Is that about the same that BMW dealers have had to spend for the i3 and i8 repairs?
Okay, so there's two different types of repairs that we need to separate here. One is body repairs, which is aluminum. We mentioned carbon fiber and the thermoplastic, but not the aluminum. We've been repairing aluminum for the last, I think it's 11 or 12 years, since we started using the Grav front end. And this is all bonding and riveting. So we have this technology, we have the tools and the know-how. Carbon fiber, there was an investment, and honestly, I don't know what that figure was, but it's not every dealer because we don't have service shops that are doing this. We have BMW certified collision repair centers throughout the country, and they, of course, have the tooling and the know-how. The other one is the battery, and that's a really interesting point that I didn't mention earlier, which is that the battery is repairable. So in some cars, if you have any component, whatever it is, whether it's a cell supervisory circuit or a relay box or a module, it doesn't matter. If anything failed, you have to replace a very expensive battery. In this case, our dealers, every one of our 338 dealers has a trained technician who's trained to go into that battery and open it up, replace the necessary component if that were to happen, and then close it back up and test it.
Including individual cells within the battery?
Not individual cells. Okay. This battery has 8 modules. Each one has 12 cells in it, and those are replaced as a block.
Or a module.
Because the modules are essentially welded together.
We're going to have to take another break here, but John Kelly, thanks so much for coming on the show and especially for making sure there's an i3 in the studio with us. Great having you here.
Thank you for having me.
We could tell you about the years of research and development, how we forged advanced high-strength steel to make the frame stronger yet lighter. The countless hours spent testing the suspension and tuning every sound from the engine to the trunk. But until you get behind the wheel, you have no idea. The completely redesigned Hyundai Sonata.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
So I like this car. I've driven it. I can't say I've driven it extensively. I've had one really good chance to drive it. And I know some people amongst our colleagues have said, oh, that's not a real BMW. You know, it doesn't handle right. I don't agree. I really enjoy driving this car.
One of my only complaints, and as I said, I've only driven it at an event where we took it up on Mulholland Drive and near Malibu. And handling was good. I found the ride a little brittle on a rough road.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, one day, one time on one road. So I'm looking forward to, in a few weeks, getting an i3 with the range extender and spending a lot more time in it to get a, you know, longer-term impression of the whole package.
Mm-hmm. Part of it might be the tires, right? Aren't those, low rolling resistance tires? And they tend to make a car feel hard.
Yeah, and they also look to me a little bit aggressive, like they were trying to make up for low rolling resistance with, more of a, not an all season. I know they are all season, but it looked more like a performance car kind of tread pattern. So maybe they were a little rough because of that.
Could be.
Well, as we go forward in time, the definition of what a car is going to begin to vastly change. So what a BMW is, the expectation is going to change, and what a Chevy is going to change, and what all these vehicles are going to change, and it's going to be driven by technology more than anything, which leads us to an interesting graphic, I think, that we have here.
Oh, yeah? What you got?
All right. So first of all, a terabyte, okay? So if we wanted to download a terabyte, it would take a day. Okay, so that's how...
It's a lot of information.
It's a lot of
ones and zeros.
So the Library of Congress, okay, which has more than 37 million books and 5.5 million maps and 1.7 pieces of sheet music, 69 million manuscripts. Okay, the Library of Congress, the biggest library in the United States. How big do you think that is, terabyte-wise? I'll tell you.
Okay, 10.
Close. 20.
20.
Oh. 20 terabytes. So
there is an automotive angle to this. Right?
There is an automotive angle to this. Okay. So I just want to set up 20 terabytes Library of Congress, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this outfit that does automotive analysis called SBD. Now they predict that by 2020 there'll be 33 million smart cars sold. I don't mean smart as in the Daimler brand, I mean cars with intelligence. And so they're looking at that, and they're expecting that the amount of data that will be generated by these 33 million smart cars on an annual basis will be 163 million terabytes of data.
That's staggering.
It's staggering. So here's the thing that I begin to wonder about in terms of the automotive angle and in terms of how technology is going to change automobiles. So when you're dealing with these numbers like that, I mean, doesn't it begin to make sense that companies like Google will have a bigger role to play in the auto industry than traditional auto manufacturers because of, I mean, this is just, you know, for 1 year, yeah, 163 million terabytes of data.
But then you got to get into, okay, how much of that data just goes into operating the car, i.e., how many pieces of data does it take to fire just one fuel injection multiple times a second versus the kind of data that customers are bringing into?
Connectivity sort of thing that, you know, when we have vehicle-to-vehicle, vehicle-to-infrastructure, so it's, mm-hmm, it's, you know, not just... You know, your car with the ECU, you know, causing,
right,
things
but,
to happen.
But what I've read, and I hope I've got this ratio right, that when we drive our cars today, and this will change in the future, 90% of the data being generated is towards the kind of stuff that I talk. Run the engine, shift the transmission, make sure the anti-lock brakes don't lock and all that. Mm-hmm. And 10%. Is info coming in for the driver and or passengers and going out for the drivers and passengers? So that would be my question. How much of this
let's say it's just 10%.
That's still huge.
13 million terabytes of data.
Right.
So what is the capacity of the cloud then to hold all this data?
It better be pretty
clouds.
Damn big, huh?
Yeah. Multiple clouds.
And going back to your original setup, what exactly is a smart car? What are they considering a smart car? Is every car on the road today a smart car because it has so much computer power, or are they saying...
No, they're talking about the connected vehicle, that the vehicles that are talking to other vehicles and
so bringing, they're talking specifically connectivity-related intelligence?
More or less,
vehicle,
yes.
As opposed to operational intelligence?
So it's the difference between a smartphone and a phone, right?
But think about it. You know, once you get cars talking to each other and the infrastructure... Yeah, now mega amounts of data are going up, and it's still akin to what I was talking about of how much data does it take to run the injectors. Yeah. But nonetheless, now once you've got data of where a car is, what it's doing, that sort of thing, and when you start doing pattern recognition, this is where the Googles and the other big data and analytic kind of companies want to get access to all that information.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're going to have a different scene there with things like that.
Well, you know, recently we've run into GM and John Deere filing lawsuits against companies saying you cannot get into our software code and manipulate it in any way or use it in any way. I really think the big picture here is exactly looking down the road to what you're talking about, Gary. They don't want the Googles, the Apples, and whomever getting access to that data and making a bunch of money off it. The car companies want to be able to make the money on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so big change. Another big change is I saw that you reported on Daily today about the Tesla sales are are taking off. And the diesel sales, you also reported in a separate piece. What's going on?
Well, it's cheap gasoline prices. And, you know, what I find very interesting is we started to see hybrid car sales drop even before the gasoline prices dropped. So everyone thinks, oh, it's only because of that. But when gasoline prices really did get cheap, then we really did start to see the impact on hybrids, but not diesels. But now, as of right now, diesel passenger cars sales are down sharply, double digits, 22% if I remember right. In SUVs and light trucks, they're up, but they're not up as much as the rest of the market. So now diesels in pass cars are going down, and if you look at the diesels all over, they're starting to lose market share. Whereas for the last few years, they've only been gaining share.
And Tesla's outselling Jaguar now?
And Tesla outselling Jaguar, which is, to me...
The whole brand, Jaguar?
The whole brand.
Wow.
Now, I'm talking just in the U.S. market.
Yeah.
But to make the numbers easy, Tesla has sold about 11,000 cars this year in the U.S. Jaguar has sold about 7,500. And that, to me, that's a real eye-opener because, A, Jaguar has four models. Tesla has one. Mm. Even more telling is Tesla's legally barred from selling cars in, I want to say, most of the states. You legally cannot go and buy a...
probably 50-50 now, isn't it? Something
maybe like it is 50. Yes. But nonetheless, Jaguar you can buy in every single state of the union.
Yep.
Tesla, maybe half of them. And still, it's easily outselling it. And as I said in Daily today... Let's not just pick on Jaguar. If you look at any high-end luxury car, just individual car, S-Class, you know, Mercedes 7 Series, BMW, A7, Audi, Tesla pretty much outsells them all. And so I'll bet, and I'd love to see that somebody do this, and I don't have access to the data. I'll bet if you look at cars priced over $100,000, I'll bet Tesla's at the top of the list or awfully damn close to the top of the list.
What about serviceability, though? To me, that's a big issue because there are no Tesla dealers.
Correct.
There are stores, right, like Apple stores. You can buy one. But if you need it serviced, what are they, going to helicopter a technician out to your
house? Well, see, but I just want, I wonder, and I've seen one in New York, and I've seen one, I can't remember the other city, is that they have certified service centers, okay, and it sounds almost like what we heard with BMW,
right,
that all of the places don't have the wherewithal to fix this carbon fiber,
right,
but there are places that are certified to fix these things.
That's a great point.
So that changes the model. So you don't go back to your local dealer. What you do is you go to one of these certified places.
But I'm not talking about, you know, they can download, they can send you, you can download a software upgrade.
They do the,
okay,
the
or
over
even
the over-the-air apps.
But if your door handle falls off.
Right.
Right.
Know,
well, then you take it one of these certified places.
Or won't open, which has happened quite a bit with Tesla.
If something physically breaks, what do you do? Where do you take it? How do you get it serviced? If you're in Southern California, they'll send somebody out. Right. If you're in Michigan,
In Michigan, you will flatbed your Tesla to the service center in Ohio. But, you know, John Kelly made a good point, is, you know, these are early adopters. They'll cut a lot of slack. I mean, they see themselves like space pioneers. They're out for the good of the cause, right? And if there's some problems with the car, man, no worries. So what if they have to flatbed it 200 miles away? They don't seem to care.
But how many of those are there who can afford that car? So the sustainability, if you will, of that
The Model X comes out, $40,000. We're going to be talking about a different story.
All these thoughts. We're going to take another quick break for our friends at Fiat. We'll be back in just a moment.
The all-new Fiat 500 X crossover, featuring an available Uconnect system with a 6.5-inch touchscreen and available all-wheel drive. Well-rounded, has never looked so sharp.
Okay, we're back. So, Gary Whitzenberg, you said you had something on autonomy.
Well, there's a lot of talk, a lot of buzz about autonomous vehicles that, right now, we're semi-autonomous and the cars can keep a distance behind cars in front of them, and they can stay in their lanes and so on. And down the road, we're talking about cars driving themselves. And I read a column about this recently, and the thought suddenly occurred to me, because I was also, I'd observed and written something about massive enforcement out here on a Michigan freeway. What will the speed be of autonomous vehicles when they're driving themselves? Will it be posted limits, or will it be prevailing? Because if it's posted limits, they're 10 miles an hour slower than everybody else.
Right.
And that's not a good thing.
Right.
And I wonder if the cars will have, if somebody will have the foresight and the intelligence to say, let's make it match the prevailing speed and forget about what's on the signs.
That's a great question. That will be resolved in the courts, because right now the big worry on the part of automakers is that they're going to be liable for autonomous cars. Today it's the operator, you know, the driver. The car gets in an accident. Were you at fault or not? And that's what gets debated. In the future with autonomous cars, it's going to be, hey, clearly there's nobody operating. It's this, the software writers, the car manufacturers, the supply, whatever. So liability is going to be transferred to them. And they are going to say, make it obey every single law, i.e., only drive the speed limit,
but
not the prevailing
speed.
Could
they, how could they not do that, though? I mean, seriously, if the vision system reads 70, right, and then it says to the processor, the speed limit on this road is 70, it must go 70. I mean, they can't build a fudge factor in whereby they would say, wink, wink, you can go 80.
Well, I'm going to call my local hacker, and we're going to put a wink, wink factor into my car.
See, and maybe this gets back to what you were saying before the break about how companies like General Motors don't want people to begin to monkey with their code, because it could be a situation whereby, you know, that gets buried in there somehow, and then, you know, if it exceeds the speed limit and an accident is caused as a result of the speed limit being, you know, broken, so on and so forth. But realize that if a whole bunch of autonomous cars are rolling along, they're going to be able to be platooned. They're going to be able to go, and so your door-to-door time may actually be less than if you're driving at you know, 85 and John's driving at 80 and I'm driving at 79 and we're all rushing to get someplace because of the way that traffic patterns exist now. So that's going to change.
But if they're obeying posted limits, and GPS now knows what the posted limits are in most places,
right?
Number one, that slows traffic beyond what most of us are used to, because posted limits are slower than most of us want to go by some factor. Number two, that only works if every car is autonomous,
right?
Because you'll get run over by a semi if you're driving the posted limit and you're alone on the road or one of few.
It's a great point. And I mean, boy, I remember even in my driver ed days, way back in the last century, where they would tell you, go the prevailing limit. Go keep the same speed as car.
Which is actually safer to have everybody going the same speed.
Exactly. So I wouldn't be surprised if this becomes an issue somewhere down the road, that the powers that be agree that, you know, we can design algorithms that recognize it's actually safer to go five over than the posted limit. I could see that happening. But,
or you take the cue from the traffic around you.
Okay, right? But
won't this only become an issue once the pedals go away?
Yes.
Okay, so in the meantime, in our lifetime, Gary, do not worry. You'll have that pedal. You'll be able to override your autonomous car.
I don't think Gary Witzenberg's going to buy an autonomous car, I don't think.
Well, the idea of...
the government forces him to.
Semi-autonomy is pretty good. I mean, I love the idea, as our friend Jim Hall once said when I wrote an article about this years ago. Gee, wouldn't it be great if you could pull up to a mall and then get out of the car and have the car just go find its own parking space, and then you call it back and it picks you up? I mean...
Right.
I could get into that,
right?
But the idea of it doing all the driving and me just sitting reading a book, I mean, I don't know that that's ever going to happen, or at least without the platooning that you're talking about, where there's no one else on the road except people in that conga line.
Right.
Because I think right now they're talking about there's always got to be, the driver still has to remain functional and alert in case something goes wrong or to react to emergencies or whatever. I don't know if we'll ever take the driver completely out of the equation.
So let's say the conga line's in an HOV lane, right? Yeah. And they're all just going along at the speed limit, and everybody else is in the other two lanes, and they're slicing, dicing, and ricing, and they think they're going faster, but at the end of the day, that conga line is there. They've gotten to their place. And
I believe we'll see fully autonomous cars in limited situations before the decade.
Where the driver has no role and no responsibility?
None whatsoever. But it'll be limited. And it'll be, to begin with, in a 10-mile radius around Mountain View, California, which is where Google's headquarters are. And they'll only go 25 miles an hour. But we will see autonomous cars on the road, I believe, by 2020. To the point where all cars are autonomous, that's beyond 2050. And that's an easy prediction to make.
Are you going to put your little child in a fully autonomous vehicle and send it to school and trust it?
I believe it will come to that.
Because
I
really we all do. Know computers crash, and therefore a computer-driven car then will crash.
Could crash.
Right. Didn't you watch the Jetsons? It's all going to happen.
Right.
So what do you make of so GM? We had Jeff Luke in the studio. Remember, we had the Silverado in here several months back, and you were somewhat critical of the styling, saying that it didn't look sufficiently
distinctive.
New enough.
In fact, at the launch of the Silverado, and I think we ran this picture in Autoline Daily this week when we showed the new change, I got the old truck and the new truck and put them here. It's up on the screen there. Quick, at a glance, which one's the new one? Which one's the old one?
Right side.
You're too good at this, though, Gary. But, I mean, it's hard to tell at a quick glance.
It's the grill texture is the main giveaway.
All right, do you have a 2016 that you can show?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Ben's got that. There it is.
Right.
Now that's cool.
So the 2016 will have a new front end on the Silverado, and it'll be a new front end on the GMC Sierra as well. They've changed that up.
Okay. Yeah.
So why do you think they did that? I mean, sales are doing really well for
right now. They're going
Silverado.
Right,
they're
Silverado outsold the F Series. Now somebody wrote in to say no, you got that wrong, and I wrote back to say no.
It was you wrote in
1 month
when Ford counts F Series sales, they also count the Ford F-450, 550, 650, and 750. Yeah. The 750 is a Class 7 truck.
It's got
truck.
An F in front of it.
It's got an F. Those trucks have nothing in common with the common F-150 or even 250 and 350. So if you compare just that to that, because Chevrolet does not have the equivalent of a 450 through 750, the Silverado outsold the F-Series. But anyway, getting back to what you brought up, Gary Vasilash, when the truck launched, I mean, sales were okay, but they weren't great. Meanwhile, GMC, exact same truck, but with more distinctive styling, sales were up double digits. And to me, it was obvious. You know, it's not just the brand. It's like, it's hard to tell the old one from the new one. You know, you pull up to that restaurant or the bar or something, and you say, hey, I got a new truck. And people go, yeah, when are you going to bring it in?
Yeah, right.
So now you bring one up, and people go, whoa, you got the new one.
And you think about it, I mean, this is a comparatively is the key word here, inexpensive way to change the way your vehicle looks.
But they spent way too much money, I think, Chevy did. They changed the hood. They changed, I mean, all they had to do was change the grill, maybe the headlamps. They spent
Well, I think the headlamps were key in that, don't you, Gary? I mean, in terms of going from the stacked to...
Right.
And did they change part of the fenders, too?
Not that I'm aware of.
There were at least three different things that
they had. Tail lamps are different as well.
Okay, well.
But they've had stacked headlamps since 1970-something.
But I don't understand. Why would you spend tooling money to tool up a new hood? I mean.
It looks better.
Yeah, I don't know.
For the additional clearance for the engine, we don't know about yet.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know.
That's a great speculation.
But if you're only doing a styling change, I think they could have gotten just as much effect for less money.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. Mm-hmm. But to your point, Silverado's going gangbusters right now. Ford, I'm just reading today, is discounting the F-Series in certain markets up to $10,000.
They're still saying, though, they're capacity constrained, are they not?
You know, I don't buy it.
Supply.
I don't buy it for a second because I went to Ward's and I looked up how much inventory of F-Series versus Silverado. And F-Series has something like 20,000, 25,000 more units in inventory than Chevy does. So if inventory is the issue, how come the Silverado is red hot and the F-Series is not? So,
So what's your expert analysis on why?
I'm afraid that aluminum
are better,
counts.
Or people are afraid of aluminum.
I think that's it. That's what I'm reading into it right now.
Would you want to be in an aluminum cage when a bear comes at you?
Yeah, did you see that commercial? That was actually pretty damn funny, that commercial. I got to give him credit
for
that.
We've all seen that commercial.
Yeah, that was, there was a YouTube video, I think, that they did.
Now, did Chevy just do that, those videos, to be mean? Or did some focus
mean
group...
Mean to bears or what?
No, mean to Ford. Or did some focus group stuff go, ooh, you know, we're onto something here. Truck buyers don't like the idea of namby-pamby aluminum.
Yeah, but some years... 3 or 4 years ago, the steel industry ran a similar ad, and wasn't it that it was a guy in a shark cage, and the shark is trying to get into him, and the guy's like, aren't you glad you're in a steel cage? Yeah. I mean, it was the same sort of thing. So, I mean, I think they just keyed off on that.
It's just very competitive, and they want to sell as many as they can.
I know, but the F-Series should be selling better. I'm looking at the inventory. The inventory is there. They're claiming they don't have enough.
Prices
I'm telling you they got more
right?
than Chevy.
It's not necessarily
all right, so here's the question. So we know that they had to spend a boatload of money to develop the F-Series, right? And, I mean, a boatload. And they've got the technology now. Okay, so here's the situation where Silverado wasn't doing so well. So what did they do? They said, okay, we're gonna change up the front. We're going to spend extra money to do that. Are the bean counters at Ford going to allow the program manager and the designers say, you know, we got to put a new front end on the F-150. We got to do something. We got to make it more appealing. Or they're going to say, damn, we just spent all that dough. We can't do that. What do you think?
They have to sell what they got, first of all. And they call it military-grade aluminum to try to give it that.
But there would still be aluminum. They just want to.
It's an interesting question, Gary, because when the Silverado first launched, and I talked to the design guys, like, guys, I'm having a hard time telling one from the other. It was like, oh, no, our truck, you know, we clinic this. Everybody loves it. No, we're not going to have to do an emergency refresh in 2 years. No, not at all. And guess what happened? They had to do an emergency refresh in 2 years.
What about transaction prices, though?
That's a good question.
Is there more money on the hood of the Chevy than the Ford, or is the Ford a higher cost?
Well, that's been the argument up to now, is that, oh, Chevy's discounting so much. But now the news just came out in the last day in certain markets and spreading Ford on the very high-end ones, you know, the full cab 4x4 Lariat LXT or whatever it is, that they're discounting up to $10,000 off the truck. So I'm telling you, just my gut feel tells me Ford's got a bigger issue on its hands than what it's admitting publicly.
I would guess their trucks are higher cost also because of the aluminum. So if they can't price more for that cost, then they don't have the margins.
But and it's more than that. I mean, they still use cam and block, right? Overhead valve. Ford's got overhead cam. An overhead cam V8 is $1,000 more to manufacture than
not necessarily an advantage in a truck.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, look, everybody was surprised when the EPA numbers came out on the Ford truck. I think everybody, including the people at Ford, thought the numbers would be much better than they turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chevy can argue V8 to V8, their V8 gets better fuel economy.
Well, and there's an issue, too, that you mentioned, because the EcoBoost brand name, wonderful brand name, perhaps the best ever for direct injection, fuel injection, turbocharging and dual variable valve timing. It's great. It's proving now in real life to be not as fuel efficient as people expect. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction, I think, out there among owners of cars and trucks.
On the fuel economy, they love the way the engine drives.
Yeah,
they love that.
But they're not getting what the label promises and the advertising promises, and maybe that's beginning to catch up to them.
And speaking of powertrain, there are big news today with Magna, and we've had Magna on the show, buying Getrag, the transmission manufacturer.
How ironic that, you know, just a few months ago, ZF, a supplier company, runs out and buys... a transmission company primarily runs out and buys a supplier, and now Magna, a supplier, runs out and buys a transmission company.
Yeah.
And so the consolidation continues. Fewer and fewer suppliers.
As predicted by many.
Right.
This will happen.
So is this good news or bad news for if you're an OEM?
Well, that's a good question.
You have fewer sources to bounce off each other or to try to get a better deal from?
Well, look, here's what's driving it. Suppliers are saying...
If you have a single source, that's not a good thing normally.
The big suppliers are all looking around and saying, what's our strategy? What are going to be growth technologies that we should be in? And they go, okay, CO2 reduction, that's a good one. Safety, that's a real good one. All this connected car, autonomy, there's another good one to be in. And I think what Magna looked at is, boy, we do all kinds of powertrain stuff. And when we look at transmissions, boy, you know, EVs, maybe they don't need as many gears, but they need a transmission. Hybrids and plug-ins and fuel cells and piston. It's they're looking around going, we think transmission's going to be around for a long time. Yeah. And besides, Magna does a lot of electronic stuff, and you can just throw more and more electronics into transmissions. Mm-hmm. That's why I think they went for it.
So you think it's a good idea?
What, that suppliers buying other suppliers?
Or in this case...
That's the question?
Yeah.
If they think it's a good idea, I guess it is. If they're lowering their total costs and expanding their breadth of what it is they supply, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, Kodak thought staying with film was a good idea.
Yeah, I don't have a strong opinion. Can we get back to trucks for one minute?
Go
it just
ahead.
Occurred to me, while Chevy and Ford are battling it out, Ram's sneaking up on both of them. They're gaining market share just about every month, are they not?
They have. I don't know about the last month. I haven't looked at the numbers, but you're right. Ram's been going
very,
gangbusters.
Very nice trucks, and they're selling quite well, I understand.
And they've moved into the medium-duty range that Chevy and GMC have not. I got to say, GM just recently re-signed a deal with Isuzu to get back into medium-duty trucks.
Yeah.
You know, those cab overs that they've been making in the past.
And midsize. Mm-hmm. Colorado Canyon doing great. Now we have if not all new, at least well refreshed Tacoma. Are we going to see Fords and Rams and everybody else now going back into midsize?
All right. So.
Yeah. How can you let Chevy get away? Yeah. GM, you know, Chevy and GMC. Yeah. You know, they're going to do over 100,000 trucks of those Colorados and Canyons this year. If you're Ford, can you really go, who cares if they got another 100? I think you got to react somehow.
The three ways that I've written this in reviews of them, but the ways the truck makers are getting to meet CAFE, you got diesel in the Ram, you got aluminum in the Ford, and you got midsize in the GMs.
Right.
How long will it be before all three are doing all three?
Good question.
Because I think they're going to have to. There'll be more aluminum trucks. There'll be more midsize trucks throughout the industry, I think.
I think you're right. What else? We probably got time for one other item. You got something there, Gary, or no?
Well, I thought it was interesting. For the first time ever, we saw pictures of Sergio Marchionne's elbows.
He wasn't wearing a sweater?
He wasn't wearing a sweater. He was wearing a golf shirt for the beginning of the negotiations with the UAW. It was shocking to see that.
That's big news.
It is big news. I mean, because we've never seen his arms. Or at least his elbows. That's going to be interesting to see how this works out, because Sergio came out and said that he didn't think that there should be the two wage scale that was, the way that...
But his idea is get rid of the high wage, make everybody work for peanuts.
There could be that. I don't know how well that would work out for him. But I just wonder whether this is a negotiating tactic for his grand scheme to have somebody come and buy him.
You mean showing his elbows?
Your elbows?
Well, there's that too. There's selling. But to begin to think that, he wants to become more appealing to someone.
Yeah, that seems to be his plan right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just flip it. Buy it, fix it up, and flip it.
Yeah.
And they're spending an awful lot of money to revive Alpha, are they not?
They are, or will be.
That's a nice-looking car, but will it sell? Will it be profitable? Will it return on that investment?
Well, that's just one of five models that they're going to dump in the market in the next 3 years. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
They're going to try to go up against our pals at BMW and Mercedes and everybody else.
Not going to be easy.
And Tesla.
That's right.
Right.
Hey, let's wrap it up, guys. Right. But right. Gary Whitzenberg, thanks for coming in. Always
My
good to
pleasure.
Have an EV
Anytime.
Expert when we're talking about an EV in the studio. And Gary Vaslash, let's do it again next week.
Next week. Okay, Jen.
I want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Fiat. Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.